Right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see everybody here this morning. Morning, good morning. Nice to see you. We're continuing with the life story and the writings of a Rav Avadia Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, one of the most influential Rabbonim in the 20th century, particularly in the world, in the Sephardi world, but also in the Ashkenazi world, and you can see in the sheet in front of you, he started off as a chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and then he was chief rabbi of Israel. And I'd like to try and give you a bit of a taste, a bit of a sense of the man and of his impact and the way in which he his goal in life, as I mentioned to you a few times, is written here on the sheet in front of you underneath his name, L'chazir Atara L'yoshna, to restore the importance and the glory, in a certain sense, of Sephardic Jewish life, which had been lost in the first part of the 20th century by the fact that so many Jewish, the main Jewish communities in the Eidot HaMizrach lands had been expelled and exiled and had lost their property, had lost their leadership, and had lost, in many cases, had lost their Judaism. Right? But we're dealing with many hundreds of thousands, maybe more than that, of Jews who come from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, the Iraq, Persia, Kazakhstan, all these different communities had brought with them, should have brought with them, a tremendous amount of Torah from Sfarad, but in many cases didn't do so. And he, remarkably, I mean, I tell you, when you think about it, when you read the story, it's a remarkable achievement of a single man, how he was able to use his formidable intellect and his understanding and his Torah knowledge to create a platform for himself from which he really transformed Jewish life in this way. One of the interesting things he did was that he wasn't only focused on the Sephardi population of the land of Israel, but actually he made it his business wherever there was a Sephardi community in the world, he would travel. He traveled the world, and wherever he went, he was received royally, and he had an enormous impact on the Jewish community in that town. One of the famous stories is when he went to visit Spain. Now, today, Spain doesn't have many big communities anymore, but it used to be the center of Jewish life before 1492. And so he went to visit Spain, and he was received by King Carlos of Spain. This was during his time as chief rabbi of Israel, probably late 70s. Of course, when he travels in his full regalia, right? I'm sure you've seen pictures of Rabbi Yosef in his full robes, purple robes, and his turban. And he always wore sunglasses because he had very, very sensitive eyes, very, very light sensitive eyes. When he arrived in Spain, he arrived at the airport literally on a red carpet. I remember seeing pictures of this, on a red carpet with bands, with music, and with the royal guard, and with thousands of people, Jews, Christians, Arabs, everybody welcoming this man. Of course, most of them didn't have the faintest idea who he was, but they knew that he was one of the leaders, world leaders of the Jewish people, and they'd never met anybody even remotely like that before. And there was a sort of a police escort, and the police escort referred to him as the Jewish Pope. He was the Jewish Pope for them, right? They'd never seen anything even remotely like this before. One of the interesting stories I remember reading, this was typical of his very personal touch. On the one hand, he had a global vision, but he had a personal touch. is that there were dozens of security men who were driving alongside of his car and before him and after him and were with him all the time there in Spain. And he afterwards he asked to meet them. He asked to meet them, and of course they didn't understand what he was talking about because he was speaking Hebrew, they only speak Spanish. For a bit of it, maybe they had an interpreter, I don't remember exactly the story, but he wanted to give them a bracha, he wanted to thank them for looking after him and protecting him, and they were very moved by this, and this then became a story in the whole country. There was a story. One of the interesting things that King Carlos asked him, which also is recorded, because he had a very interesting conversation with him, was, why is it that so many Jewish communities in places like Morocco and Yemen and Iraq, communities who've never been to Spain, why are they called Sfaradim? Why do you call these communities the Sfaradim? We are Spain, right? King Carlos says we are the Spanish the source of Spanish culture and Spanish Jewry. Why are all these communities labeled as Sfaradim? It's a good question, right? We generally refer to them as the Sfaradi communities of Morocco. In what sense is the Moroccan community Sfaradi? They've never been to Spain in their life. And certainly the communities of Iraq and of Kazakhstan have never been to Spain in their life. Why is this Spain, right? So what do you say, Elazar?
I come from Spain.
Well, yes, okay. If you could say that actually all these communities grew up only after the Girush Sfarad, after the expulsion from Spain. And historically, that's how they developed. They were all exiled from Spain. Incidentally, in that meeting, King Carlos expressed his deep regret and sort of gave a royal apology to Obadiah Yosef for the way the Jews of Spain had been treated in 1492. But what's interesting is that, of course, Obadiah Yosef is more of a halachist than a historian. So when he's asked the question, why is it that the Jews, say, of Yemen and Egypt and Iraq, why are they called Spanish Sephardi Jews? So he said it's because they all follow the authority of the Rambam, of Maimonides, right? Maimonides, right, who was born in Cordoba, right, in 1138. Maimonides was born in Cordoba. Cordoba is a town in Spain, in the south of Spain. It's not far from Gibraltar, I think, Cordoba. Is that true, right? Not far from Gibraltar. The town of Cordoba is famous as the birthplace of Maimonides, and it was his influence and his halachic authority was accepted by all these the common denominator. From a rabbinic point of view, the common denominator of all these different communities that we mentioned, all the Eidot HaMizrach, thank you very much. The common denominator is that they were accepting the rulings of Maimonides, of the Rambam, and because of that they were Spanish. And that gave the King Carlos a great pride, you know, that his country had in some way continues to be a central feature of Jewish life. And I think the king today of Spain is his son, right?
The son.
King Philip. Philippe, I don't know if they call it Philip.
Felipe.
What do you say?
Felipe.
Actually, he's a cousin of the British royal family. They're all these kings and queens are all great grandchildren of Queen Victoria, if I'm not mistaken. For some reason, I'm not quite sure exactly how this works, but they're all related to each other. And this is the club of the royal families. But King Carlos welcomed Obadiah Yosef as royalty and gave him a royal welcome and a royal. And this gave, if you like, the Sfaradi communities, wherever he went, gave them a sense of pride and a sense of importance and a sense that they weren't ignored and that they weren't insignificant. And that was his goal. When he went to Spain, he wasn't going there as a tourist, you understand? He wasn't going there to look around at the beauty of the country. He went in order, lahachzir atara liyoshna, that everybody should see that the Spanish Jewry were considered important in the eyes of the nations of the world, in the eyes of the rest of the Jewish world. And he had it was a very sophisticated plan of his. For example, in his several visits that he paid to South America, where he went to Venezuela, right? He went to Brazil, went to Peru, he went to all these different communities in South America. And wherever he went, it was a major event. It was in the press, right? And he arrived like a king, right? And he was viewed as royalty in that sense. And he was the chief rabbi of Israel. That was not a small matter, right? And by going around the world, he was a sort of an emissary, almost an ambassadorial role of his to represent the importance of the Sephardi tradition and Sephardic Jewry worldwide. And wherever he went, he gave a tremendous chizuk, a tremendous boost. He went to all the schools, and he went to the yeshivas, and he went to the communities, and he gave drashot, and he had an interpreter with him whenever he went. He couldn't speak English, but wherever he went, it was either Spanish or English or whatever it was, interpreters he had with him. And this was a part of his goal in life, in which he was extremely successful, right? That he was able to present a figure of royalty. Don't forget, the Jewish communities in all these places felt a bit nebuch, a bit neglected, a bit insignificant. And his arrival and his connection, and then he would also raise funds for them, and he built buildings, and he published books in these places, and he gave a chizuk to the rabbis of the place, and he built new yeshivas wherever he went. So in that sense, he was really a one-man revival program worldwide. I don't know anybody else really who did anything similar in that sense, right? A bit similar maybe to what the Lubavitcher Rebbe did world, also wanted to have a global effect, right? But the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself didn't travel to any of these places. He had a different strategy, right? He sent shluchim there, he sent his emissaries out, and he empowered them, and he instructed them, and he gave them a chizuk, and then they went out to the four corners of the world, right? Rav Avdi Yosef didn't have shluchim in that sense, but he went personally. He went personally to all these different places several times. He was in Los Angeles, he was in New York, he went to visit the Syrian community, there's a big Syrian community in New York, Rabbi Dweck. He went to visit there a few times. Every time he went, it was a televised event, and it was a publicized. And what was his goal? His goal wasn't for his own personal fame. His goal was lahachzir atara liyosha. And this was a remarkable achievement.
Rabbi,
yes, at that time, Israel didn't have diplomatic relationships with Spain.
And he said to the king,
yes.
After that,
right. They established a relationship. Yes, wherever he went, he was always also aware of the fact that he wasn't just an ambassador for the Sephardi Jewish community, he was an ambassador for Israel. He was the chief rabbi of Israel, so he was really making connections and raising support in many different ways. And this was something which I think it was quite remarkable. I remember he came once to London. Rabbi Gabai in London hosted him in London, and also there he gave shiurim to the rabbonim, and he gave a big chizuk to the local Sephardi communities, but also the Ashkenazi rabbonim all came to consult him and discuss with him, and he really made an enormous personal impact. One of the interesting things about Rav Avdi Yosef was that he didn't waste a second. That he was learning all the time. And this was something nobody had ever seen before, actually, in terms of the people who... So in other words, when he was traveling, whenever he was waiting somewhere, he was always learning. He was always learning. He often had a sefer with him, and if he wasn't learning with us, he didn't really need a sefer, you understand? It was all up on the hard disk. It was all memorized completely. But they even wrote about him when he was in France. They even wrote about him that, you know, he used to speak for 10 minutes, and then the translator used to say it over in French. So he was standing there for 10 minutes while the translator was saying it over, and during that time he was learning. During those few minutes, he was going over Mishnayos, going over Gemaras, going over Rishonim. He had a Seder HaLimud, which he was constantly remembering and revising and learning for himself Torah, like nonstop. Not to mention on the plane, on the bus, and in the car, he was constantly learning. And then when he arrived, he was full on. He was able to present his message in the most remarkable way. Baruch Atah. I should have mentioned at the outset that this shiur has been sponsored by Ilui Nishmas Miriam Bas Avraham and Shem Tov Ben Shlomo. I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the shiur. In this objective of his to restore the Sfaradi Psak, there were lots of very interesting details in his writings, and of course the literature that he produced is massive, and the current chief rabbi of Israel, of course, the Sfaradi chief rabbi of Israel, Yitzchak Yosef, has published a whole set of Sfarim called Yalkut Yosef. Must be about 20 volumes or 30 volumes of extraordinary quantity of material, really on the halachas that he'd learnt from his father and with his father and from the shiurim of his father. So and he's got another son called Rav David Yosef, who is a Rosh Yeshiva and who is an Av Beis Din, and has also published lots of material on this subject. There are one or two halachas, though, which may seem to be small details, but which he came back to again and again. And maybe I'll just share one or two with you. So one of them is a very interesting one. And here it goes. Ladies and gentlemen, hadlokas ner Shabbos. Who doesn't know about lighting Shabbos candles? And here comes the important halachic question here. The question isn't should you or shouldn't you light Shabbos candles. Obviously you should. It's a special mitzvah, Kovod Shabbos. But do you make the bracha before you light or do you make the bracha after you light? That's the question. So ladies here, ladies, what do you do? Do you make the bracha before you light or after you light the candles? After. Everyone lights. Everyone here is lighting, making the bracha after you light the candles. Why do you do that? Why do we make the bracha after you light? We have a general principle that we make brachas before we do the mitzvah. If you're going to blow the shofar, you make the bracha before blowing the shofar. You're going to put on your talis and tefillin, you make the bracha before. If you're going to eat matzah, you make the bracha before you do the mitzvah. And the Gemara says that that's a special condition of all brachas, that they should be made before, over what's called over la'asiyasam. Before you do the mitzvah, you've got to make the bracha. The bracha is meant to be an introduction or a preamble to doing the mitzvah. Right? Where do we find that you make the bracha after you've done the mitzvah? It doesn't make sense according to the general principles of the halachic understanding of brachas. So where does this come from? Anybody know?
It's because lighting candles is asur on Shabbos.
Okay, so lighting candles is also on Shabbos, and therefore what? So what's that got to do with the bracha?
So you can't make the, by the time you brought in Shabbos, by making the bracha.
Okay, so here's the thing. There was one view, which was a minority view, from what's called the Samag, the Sefer Mitzvah Sagadol, right? And the Bahag, that they were one of the Baalei HaTosfot in Ashkenaz. They took the view that making the bracha, Lahadlik Neshel Shabbos, is an act of Kabbalat Shabbat. Most of the Rishonim disagreed with them. Most of the Rishonim took the view that making the bracha lahadlik neshel Shabbos just means, what are you doing? You're lighting candles lichvod Shabbat. You do lots of things lichvod Shabbat. You lay the table lichvod Shabbat. You change into your Shabbos clothes lichvod Shabbat. Right? All these things you do lichvod Shabbat, but you do them before Shabbos comes in. Right? The fact that you're doing something lichvod Shabbat is not in and of itself Kabbalat Shabbat. If you start laying the table Friday afternoon and say, right, I'm now laying the table Lichvod Shabbat, you haven't received the Shabbos, you're just preparing for Shabbos. Similarly, the predominant view in the halachic literature, and certainly in the Sfaradi literature, it's the 100% view, which is that making the bracha Hadlik Neshel Shabbat is not at all an act of Kabbalat Shabbat. It's an act of anticipating Shabbat. It's a preparatory act for Shabbos, which is not, you can make the bracha, light the candles, and you can still make yourself a cup of coffee. If Shabbos hasn't come in yet, you can still do lots of different things. You can still light the candles, and still drive to shul, right? Because the bracha, lahadlik ner shel Shabbos, according to majority opinion, certainly in the Sephardi world, but even in the Ashkenaz world, what happened was, in about, I think it was about the 14th century, there's recorded a minhag, which is recorded as miktzat nashim. Some women do it differently. Some women, because they had heard that the bracha is kabbalat, that they're receiving the Shabbos by making the bracha, so they did it. They first lit the candles and then made the bracha. Then this then was picked up by the Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch, and this then became the predominant custom. How certain minhagim become so predominant is in itself often a bit of a mystery. It's a bit of a mystery. Subject for a PhD research for somebody. How certain minhagim catch on and become the norm, right? So much so that I could say, I could probably ask this question of any group of women and ask who makes the bracha first. And you probably find hardly anybody. Rav Avadi Yosef, one of the things Rav Avadi Yosef said repeatedly was that certainly for the women of from Sephardi communities, the right thing to do is to follow the general principles of halacha and make the bracha, lahadlik ner shel Shabbos, light your candles, and you haven't received the Shabbos yet. You can still make yourself a cup of coffee. That is the norm according to 90% of the halachic views of the Rishonim. That's the view. There is a small school of thought among the Ashkenaz poskim that you should do it first. You should first light the candles and then. But he says this has got all sorts of problems. One of the problems, incidentally, is that the Gemara says that the word lehadlik, this form always refers to something you're about to do. It's not something that you've done already, right? We say lahabo mashma, says the Gemara. Lahabo mashma means it's the meaning of the word is it's for the future, right? If it's done already, then it's daluk. It's already lit. The candle is daluk, right? Right. The candles are. But when you use the word lahadlik, it's a question of the. Relating to a future event. So to light the candles and then to say the hadlik doesn't even make sense completely in terms of Hebrew grammar. Anyhow, the bottom line is minhagim don't follow the rules of Hebrew grammar, and minhagim don't follow the rules, really, of majority views of the halacha either, right? Majority view is, definitely, that you should first make... But, I mean, if I would try and tell my wife this, she'd think that I'm completely mad, right? Like, she'd think that I'm completely fallen... I've fallen on my head if I try and tell her that she should first make the bracha and then light the candles. This would be completely, I would say, almost verging on apikorsis, almost, that it's something completely unacceptable. But it's important to know. It's important to know. Why is it important to know? I want to tell you why it's important to know for all of you. Because sometimes you can be in an unusual situation. You can be in a situation of pressure of some sort. That you still have to maybe, I don't know, you need to go to the hospital. You have to light the candles, and you still need to drive to the hospital. How can I light the candles? And then go to the hospital. The answer is, you make a tanai in your head. You say, I am now going to make the bracha on the candles, and I'm not mekabel Shabbat yet. Because there's still another 20 minutes, still or half an hour till Shabbos comes in. I'm not yet, and that everybody agrees you can do that. Everybody insists you can make a tadai and not yet receive the Shabbos, because the bracha lahadlik ner shel Shabbos does not mean ani mekabel Shabbos. That's what it means. It means I am now doing something preparatory lichvod Shabbat, right? And therefore, there is no implication of Kabbalat Shabbat. Yes, Emmett. Yes, yes, yes. According to Rav Yosef, you're Makabel Shabbat. You know when you're Makabel Shabbat? when the tzibur says Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbat, then you're Makabel Shabbat.
That's for the men, no?
But also for the women, for everybody. Everybody's Makabel Shabbos. The truth is, Shabbos comes in when it's Shkia, right? So we want to be a bit of Tosefet Shabbat. So we say Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos and say Baruch Hu before Shabbos comes in, right? So we're Makabel Shabbos always a little bit in advance. But when you light the candle, now was lighting, the fundamental issue here is that lighting the candle is like everything else you do, lichvod Shabbat, right? You lay the table, you get dressed, take a shower, all these things are not acts of accepting Shabbos, they're acts of preparatory for Shabbos. And similarly, hadlakas neiros. And therefore, anyhow, bottom line is, the minag is definitely you first light the candles and then make the bracha. And I'm not trying to tell you to change your minhag at all. But I am telling you two things. I'm telling you, first of all, that Rabbi Avadya Yosef, if he was here, he would tell you, you're making a mistake, right? That's what he would say to you. And he would bring you a long list of makorot, of rishonim and achronim, who say that, oh, obviously you're going to first make the bracha, because we always make brachas before we do the mitzvah, and because lahadlik means before, and that's the right way to do it. Now, it's true there is a minhag, and he does acknowledge there is a minhag Ashkenaz to do it the other way, and if that's your minhag, stick to it. But if you're in a difficult situation, a pressurized situation, you should know you can always make the bracha, light the candles, and still drive if it's not yet Shabbos, right? So this is, if you make a tanai in your mind that you're not makabel Shabbos, this is an important thing to know. Why am I mentioning this? Because it's a small detail in Jewish practice, right? Bracha before, bracha after, it's a small detail. But he came back to this thing again and again. It was one of his, how shall I put it, one of his hallmark piskei halacha, telling people, because he was upset that Sephardi women had absorbed a minag Ashkenaz, where the minag Ashkenaz itself was a very dubious minag, which had not very much source, not many much of a background. Right. Okay.
Yeah, so can she still do that?
Not really. If a woman generally sort of first lights the candles and then makes the bracha, then the implication of that is, why is she doing that? The only justification for that is that her bracha, Hadlik Neir for Shabbos, is Kabbalat Shabbat. What she can do is ask somebody else in the house to do that. Yes, but she can't herself do anything anymore.
If she did it the other way around.
If she did it the other way around, then that's fine. If she first made a bracha and then lit the candles, then it's clear that her bracha is not Kabbalat Shabbat. It's not Kabbalat Shabbat, right? Because it's because she's still gonna light the candles, right? And that's also clear. That's also clear. It's not the lighting of the candles that's Kabbalah Shabbos. Don't forget, lighting the candles is an act of Chilul Shabbos. It can't be the lighting of the candles, because the lighting of the candles is Isur, is Osir, forbidden on Shabbos. The only thing that can be Kabbalah Shabbos is the bracha, right? So that's a question about how you understand the meaning of the bracha. So there were some, the Marami Rottenburg and Ozaruah, kind of the later poskim in Ashkenaz, they took the view that maybe there's a sofek, that maybe this bracha might be Kabbalah Shabbos, so do it afterwards. You know where it comes up, incidentally, it's coming up very, very soon. This whole discussion comes up in the question which is raised in the Shulchan Aruch on Erev Shabbos Chanukah. Erev Shabbos Chanukah is coming up, right? Shortly. And Erev Shabbos Chanukah, in every Jewish household, you have to light Shabbos candles and Chanukah candles. Okay, when you've got two mitzvahs to do, generally speaking, there is a principle of Todir Rasha'inu, Todir Kodim, which means if you have two mitzvahs to do, you first do the one which is more frequent. Which is more frequent. Tadir. V'sha'ina tadir, right? The one which is more frequent has priority. So what you should do is, Erev Shabbos Chanukah, at home, you should light the Shabbos candles, and then light the Chanukah candles. That's what you should do according to the principle of tadir, v'sha'ina tadir, right? It's in that context that some of the, and in fact many of the Rishonim say that's what you should do. First light Shabbos candles, and then the Chanukah candles. Why? Shabbos candles is preparation for Shabbos. Chanukah candles is it's time to light Chanukah candles. Okay? When will Shabbos come in? When the community say, this is Shabbos, Yom Shabbos. Nothing to do with candles. Do you know what's going on here? In that context, some of the Baal HaLachos Gedolos, one of the early poskim in the, of the Baal HaTosfos in Ashkenaz, said maybe there's a tzad to say, maybe, he wasn't, maybe the Hadlokas Ne'er Shabbos could be viewed as Kabbalah Shabbos, and therefore it's better to do it the other way around. First light, and that's what we do, isn't it, right? That's what we do. We first light the Hanukkah lights, and then the Shabbos lights, right? But really, that goes against the principle of Todeh V'sheino Todeh Todeh Kodem, that we should always first do that mitzvah, which is more frequent. Are you following me? So it's in Hilchos. This whole discussion takes place in the Rishonim, in the Beis Yosef, on Hilchos Chanukah, Erev Chanukah, how do you light the candles first? And it all revolves around this idea, does the bracha of Hadlokas Neira Shabbos, does it constitute Kabbalah Shabbos or not? Right? So this is in itself a... Now the truth, one of the reasons why this is complicated is that in the Gemara itself, there are no sources for this. The Gemara speaks about Shabbos candles. In fact, there's a whole peirik of Shabbos called Bame Madlikin, Bamoein Madlikin, right? Which deals with Hadlokas Shabbos. But funnily enough, in the chapter of Bame Madlikin, nowhere is it mentioned that you make a bracha on Hadlokas Neiros Shabbos. Not mentioned anywhere. It speaks about Ne'er Chanukah, and you make a bracha on Ne'er Chanukah, but the Gemara itself doesn't speak about the bracha of Ne'er Shabbos. And it could be that in the time of the Gemara, there were certain communities who lit Ne'er Shabbos without a bracha. In other words, but that became, nevertheless, that certainly became mainstream halacha at the time of the Gaonim and the Rishonim, that you make a bracha lahadlik Ne'er Shabbos. That's clear that you make that bracha. You definitely make that bracha, right? That bracha is an act of Kabbalah Shabbos, that is a minority view. That is not a majority view. That's a minority view. And all the Rishonim in Sfarad, the Ramban and the Ritva and the Rosh, all of them paskin differently. All of them say you first make a bracha, then you light the candles. Like all mitzvahs, that you make a bracha over like Asiyos. Okay. Anyhow, this shiur is not a halacha shiur, but why am I bringing you this detail? Because it was something that Rav Avadya Yosef, for some reason, this detail was very precious to him, because for him it was a detail in l'hachazir atara liyoshna, to restore the classic Sfardi psak and the classic Sfardi practice, and therefore he mentioned again and again to his Sfardi audiences, please, Erev Shabbos, make a bracha, and then light the candles. And then you can make yourself a cup of tea. Right? And then Kabbalah Shabbos comes when it comes. It comes when the community is Mekabel Shabbos. That's when Shabbos comes in. Nothing to do with your candles at all. Candles is Hachonah L'Shabbos. Like getting dressed for Shabbos is Hachonah L'Shabbos. Laying the table is Hachonah, is preparation for Shabbos. This is a subject which he used to come back to time and again, so that's why I'm sharing it with you today. Yes, what do you want to say? So that is the view, the practice that many women have got to light first and say the bracha afterwards is because there was a suggestion among some of the Ashkenaz poskim that maybe when you make the bracha, you're accepting upon yourself all the prohibitions of Shabbos. And then you can't light anymore.
But you said that's not so.
So I'm just saying that's a minority view. So Rav Avadya Yosef was kept on saying, this is a minority view. This shouldn't become mainstream. He says it has already become mainstream among Ashkenazim, right? Even though in his view it shouldn't have become mainstream among Ashkenazim, but it's already become mainstream. But please, the Sfaradi women should not accept this. Because all the Sfaradi poskim, bar none, all of them take the view that when you light the candles, you make a bracha, like all mitzvahs. The bracha is a preparation for the mitzvah. It should be done beforehand and not afterwards. Okay, so this is a very interesting point. And she understood exactly what needs to be done. Okay, so you're right. Erev Yom Kippur, you're quite right. Erev Yom Kippur, that is more common to light the candle and then still drive to shul, right? So there you need to make a tanai, but only Ashkenazim need to make the tanai. For Sfaradim, the lighting of the candle has got nothing to do with Kabbalah Shabbos or Kabbalah. It's a completely different story. It's not connected in any way. If I'm not mistaken, though, on Yom Kippur, you can make a tanai that the bracha of Hadlokas Ne'er Yom Kippur is not Kabbalah. You're not accepting it, but you can't make Shechiyonu then. You should not make the Shechiyonu. Shechiyonu should make Shechiyonu in shul later, because you can't make a tanai on Shechiyonu. Shechiyonu is something else. Shechiyonu is because the day has come in. Shechiyonu is to commemorate the fact that this is now a wonderful day, has just arrived. You can't make the Shechiyonu al tanai that the day hasn't arrived yet. Are you following me? That doesn't work. So you can make a tanai on the bracha on Hadlik, but not a tanai on the bracha. Okay, I can transform the whole shiur into the details of Hadlokas Neiros. That wasn't my intention. And that's not my intention here at all. I'm not giving you piske halachas in this shiur. I'm really transmitting to you some of the more interesting details of Rav Avadya Yosef's Torah and the things that he was particularly in love with. He was in love with this particular detail because he felt that this, in a sense, reflected how the Sfaradi communities had been deeply influenced by Ashkenazim, and lots of the Ashkenaz practices had filtered through, and he wanted to reverse that. He wanted to stop that. And that was a part of his great... Okay. So I'm afraid Judaism requires of everybody to be a little bit more broad-minded. In other words, I think everybody has to realize that the practice of Jewish life is not monolithic. In other words, it isn't one size fits all, right? There is a wide variety of different piskei halachas, and it has always been like that. It's always been like that. This is not like a new innovation of some sort, right? Going back to Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, it's quite clear from the Gemara in Yevamos that in the time of Hillel and Shammai, the people who lived in the town of Hillel actually had different halachas to the people who lived in the town of Shammai. It wasn't just an intellectual discussion between Hillel and Shammai. There were different views. There were different views within Torah. But the Torah itself allows for multiple schools of thought, different divisions, and one has to be tolerant to that. One has to be able to. It's actually quite a good maturing process. Mature people are able to understand that even though we do it one way, other people do it a different way, and that's fine. But you need to be a bit mature to understand that. Not everybody has actually reached that level of maturity. But I want to tell you, even within the Hasidic world, there are ways that the Geras do it different to the Belzers, and the Belzers to the Vizhnitzers, and the Vizhnitzers to the Chabadskas. They've got different minhagim and different practices, even within different Hasidic sects, right? And they're all aware of the fact that other people do it differently, but we do it this way, and that's fine. That shouldn't be a problem, I think, for anybody, that this is a... that people are doing differently. And one has to be very careful when you see other people doing it differently, not to jump to conclusions that they are in violation of the Torah, right? They're not in violation. They have a different Masaira, right? The problem is that the Masaira can often, in this particular case, that's what makes this case an interesting case, what happened was such a high percentage of the people who came to Israel and even to Europe from the Eidot HaMizrach, such a high percentage of them actually lost their Yiddishkeit in the process of it. By the time they arrived in Israel or in France or in New York, a very high percentage of them had lost their Yiddishkeit. And they didn't have what the Ashkenazim had, which was very powerful centers of yeshivas and rabbonim and kollels and communities. They didn't have that in the Sfaradi world. And because of that, they were lost, right? They lost their Masaira. So Rav Avadya Yosef was a one-man band, right? He was a one-man band to try and restore that Masaira, rebuild the yeshivas, rewrite the books, reintroduce the practices of the Sephardi world. All this he viewed as his life's mission, right? And he left behind a tremendous legacy of this of institutions and publications and more than that, I would say something which is in the heart of the Sephardi world, which is a certain pride. We have our Masaira. We've our Masaira, and we're proud of it. We don't have to hide it. We don't have to feel that we are second-class citizens in an Ashkenazi world. This was really, I think, his goal. And in that sense, he was very successful. I made a little note here of something which I really saw. 1978, when he was chief rabbi of Israel, he paid a visit, a big visit to France, and again there he was received like royalty, and the chief rabbi of France and everybody, and they received him various different ways. But the point that I wanted to make was that several months later, sort of the president Chirac came to Israel. And or met some Israeli things, and they asked them, how is Rabbi Avadi Yosef doing? How's he doing? And they were amazed that he knew that Rabbi Shira and the President Shira knew about Rabbi. He says, no, he made a tremendous impact when he was here. He gave blessings to people. He was he was somebody who left behind memorable events that meant a lot. That meant a lot to various individuals, whether they were Jewish or not Jewish. Okay, I brought you here in the last quarter of an hour of the Shia. I'd like to have a look at the text that you have in front of you on page number one. And what is the question here? Let me give you a brief introduction to the following question. The question is Hadlakas Neiros, on the following issue. Hadlakas Neiros, the best time for Hadlakas Neiros is nightfall. Right, when night comes. So when does night come? Let's say nowadays, for argument's sake, let's say nightfall is around 5 o'clock, roughly, right? Motzei Shabbos time, right? It's roughly around about 5 o'clock. That's when you should light the candles. That's when, according to the Gemara, that is the ideal time for lighting the candles. If you can't light the candles then our practice is that you can light them a bit later. You light them at 6, at 7, at 8, whatever it's convenient for you. But actually, the halacha is that the best time to light the candles is nightfall, right? What's interesting here is that in the Sephardi Psak, if you follow the Rambam says the only time to light the candles is at the nightfall. That's the only time to light. If in fact it's 6 o'clock and you haven't lit the candles, you've missed it. You've missed the mitzvah of Hanukkah, right? You can still light the candle. There's nothing wrong with lighting candles, but you certainly can't make brachas anymore. You can't make brachas anymore if it's later. That is the ruling of the Rambam. But it's not the Shulchan Aruch does not, and this is one of the unusual cases, where the author of the Shulchan Aruch did not follow the ruling of the Rambam. He says it's certainly preferable to light at nightfall. Again, for the Rambam, it's not just preferable, but it's essential. It's preferable to light earlier rather than later. So here's an interesting question, which comes up quite frequently. Let's say the man of the house is at work. And when does he come back from work? I don't know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. Okay, here's the question. What should he do? Here's the option. The option is he could ask his wife to light the menorah for him at the right time. The right time is 5 o'clock. He could ask his wife, please be my shliach, right? Light the candle on my behalf in the house without me. And when I come home, we'll sing Moaz Tzur together, right? We'll have some latkes together, whatever it is. I don't know what to do. But why wait and delay the lighting of the menorah till a later time, which is a questionable halacha? Why not do the mitzvah in its best way possible and ask his wife to light for him? Right, this is an interesting question. I've been asked on many occasions in England. Right, what does one do? Okay, let's have a look.
Does he hide it? Does he
husband like it when he comes back?
No, 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 no. So here's the interesting thing. Okay, so let me just give you a bit of a general Hilchos Chanukah insight. The mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is Ner Ishu Beito, which means you've got to make sure that in your house there is Chanukah lights being lit, right? If you can't make it, right, you make a shliach to light it for you. But once the Chanukah lights are lit in your house, you've done the mitzvah. That's it. You don't need to make... When you come back at 8 o'clock, if your wife lit the menorah at 5 o'clock, you only come home at 8 o'clock, you did the mitzvah with her lighting. You don't light again. Don't light. Yes?
Nightfall.
Right. So then you're in a situation where you light later. So you light definitely...
With a bracha,
yes. You light later with a bracha. Absolutely. Absolutely right. But the question is, if you have an option, you could, in a situation where you live alone, then there is no option. You can only light when you're there. But if you're not there, but if you have an option that you're not going to be there till 8, 9 o'clock, but you've got your wife at home, then maybe she can light for you at the right time. That might be a better solution. Yes, ma'am?
At 9 or 10 o'clock.
That's right. It's also an interesting thing. Sometimes one goes out to family or friends and you're present when they light the menorah. It's important to know, incidentally, you can't light the menorah in somebody else's house. I mean, you can light whatever, you can light candles wherever you like, but you can't make the bracha on Hadlokas Neiros in somebody else's house, right? It's nice to be present, say, in your kid's house, or your friend's house, or your parents' house, where they're lighting the menorah, you sit with them, eat the latkes, right, sing the Moras Tzor, and then you're going to go home at 9, 10 o'clock at night, then you're going to light your menorah.
What if you sleep there?
Okay, if you're going to sleep there, it's different. If you're staying there, then you become one of the B'nai Bayit, and you're sleeping there, that's different. But if you're 9 times out of 10, what people do is, they don't, they just say, go visit. They go for hadlocha. They go and visit their kids or their parents or their cousins, whatever it is, and they sit there when the neiros are being lit and they sing together, and it's a nice social event. But you haven't done the mitzvah of ner ishu beito in somebody else's house. Are you following me? The mitzvah is for you to light the neiros. Incidentally, also if you're in shul and there's hadlokas neiros in shul, that's not your mitzvah. Your mitzvah is to light the candles in your own house, right? And that's what you've got to do. You've got to light the neiros in your own house, right? Unless, again, you're sleeping out. Then for that night, if you're sleeping out, then that house becomes your house for that night, right? But if you're not sleeping out, and you're going to be coming back, even if you only come home at 11 o'clock at night, you've got to make the bracha and light your menorah. That's ner ish u beito. That's your house. That's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is to light the candle.
You become part of their family.
You become part of their family. What is the question that he's asked? I can see we're not going to have time really to deal with this completely, but that's all right. That's also Chanukah. Yes, next week's also still Chanukah. Yes, it's Chanukah next week. So what is the question here? Sheila. Can you see the text here under the line from his writings, Yechaveh Da'at? Rav Avadya Yosef wrote several different series of halachic books. One of them was called Yechaveh Da'at. So he says, Shela, Haim ha'ish yachol lemanot lechatchila et ishto b'to shaliach lahadlik ne'achanaka b'teisa kachav. Is it a good idea to ask your wife to light at 5 o'clock at nightfall? K'shehu ne'elat lehe'adeh b'beito at sha'am ocheres. He's under pressure. He's only going to come home from his work at 8, 9 o'clock at night, right, or 7 o'clock at night. But the real time to light is at 5 o'clock. O sha'olof cholof l'kai mitzvazu mitzvah bo yosef b'shlucha. Okay, so there's another. Okay, let's have a look. So he first deals with an interesting question, which is also a little bit complicated in terms of minhag. I never get enough time to do what I want to do, what I want to say here in these shiurim. So here's an interesting question. Are women obligated in the mitzvah of Neiros Chanukah? Interesting question. On the one hand, you might say, it is a mitzvah shehazman garoma. It's a time-bound mitzvah. And the general principle is that time-bound mitzvahs, women are exempted from. They're not excluded, but they're exempted from the obligation of time-bound mitzvahs. Does Chanukah fall into that category? So the Gemara asks that question, and when he says tshuva, the first thing he does is quote this Gemara. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos Daf Kaf Gimel Amar Rabbi Shmuel Ben Levi Noshim Chayovos B'nei Chanukah. Women are fully obligated. Obligation of women is equal to obligation of men for Ner Chanukah. She'af hein hoyu ba'oso hanes. That is the language of the Gemara. What does it mean, she'af hein hoyu ba'oso hanes? That they also benefited from Nes Chanukah. The women, like the men, were being persecuted by the Yevonim, and they were not being allowed to keep mitzvahs, and they were even persecuted more than that in many different ways. And therefore, the Nes Chanukah is a time for the women to celebrate on par with the men celebrating it. Right? So women are obligated in their Chanukah. So he says here, okay, so he gets here into a complicated discussion, which I won't go into for the moment. He compares it to Purim and Megillah. That there as well, the Gemara says exactly the same thing, that women are obligated to hear the Megillah, because afhein hayu ba'oto hanes, they also benefited from the nes of, right, the intentions of Haman was lahashmid laharog la'abed es kol ha'yehudim, to destroy genocide, to destroy the Jewish people, men and women as well. So they were equally saved. So they should also. So he asks a question about exactly whether women are obligated to hear the Megillah. They're also obligated to hear the Megillah, and then he brings down a view in Halacha that actually, even though women are obligated to hear the Megillah, they can't read the Megillah for men. For men to listen to the Megillah from a woman, that's not acceptable for various reasons. Again, I don't nearly have the time necessary to get involved in this. But he says here, I'm just going to look for a paragraph that I can just read with you. Let's move over a little bit. So basically, let's not go into Megillah for the moment, because just for time, I want to streamline the time a little bit. With regards to Ner Chanukah, a woman has an obligation like a man for her Ner Chanukah. The minhag, generally speaking, is for a married couple, that the man lights the menorah, and the woman is yotzei the mitzvah with her husband's menorah. That is normally the practice. Right? Am I right? It's normally the practice. The truth is, this is a little bit surprising. If you look at the sources, the woman has her own obligation to light the menorah, equal to that of the man. Now, in the Sfardi minhag, generally speaking, one person lights the menorah and everybody's yotzei with that, right? All the children, everybody, young children, older children, boys, girls, everybody's yotzei with the lighting of the Baal HaBayit. Just like they're yotzei with a kiddush Friday night. That's what we do, right? Everybody, the men, women, children, everybody's yotzei. Everyone does the mitzvah, listening to the kiddush Friday night. Similarly, the minhag Sfarad is one person lights the menorah and it's ner ish ubeito. And the beito is the household. Everybody. But in the Ashkenaz community, minhag is that all the kids light their own menorah. The kids, is that right? Your families, right? The children, right? Young children, older children, singles, they light their own menorah. Why should it then be that suddenly the woman, when she gets married, she doesn't light anymore? Why should she not light? She has her own mitzvah. As a single girl, she lit her own, or a divorcee, or an almona, or somebody living alone, a woman has a full obligation to light her own menorah and make her own brachas. Right? There's no question. That's not debated at all. Question only is, a married woman should have married. So the Mishnah Berurah brings down the minhag is that the married woman does the mitzvah with her husband's menorah. But I'd like to add to you that if a married woman would like to light her own menorah, right, after her husband has lit his menorah, she could light her own menorah and make a bracha, v'hadlik ner shel Chanukah, right? And in fact, many women do this. But for some reason, right, it doesn't make sense halachically that a girl should light her menorah as a single girl, and that when she's married, she stops doing the mitzvah. The mitzvah is for women equal to that of men. And why should she be yotzei with her husband's menorah when none of the kids are being yotzei with her husband's menorah, right? But we do, the Mishnah Berurah says that's the general practice, but the Mishnah Berurah says if a woman wishes to light her own menorah, right? If a woman would like to light her own menorah, she should do it, right? Alongside that of her husband and make her own brachas. So in actual fact, and that's the minhag in many families, and indeed my wife lights her own menorah, has always lit. She's Dutch, that's different, isn't it? Itamar will tell you that in Holland, slightly different practices of various sorts. But certainly, my wife lights her own menorah. After I've lit my menorah, she lights her own menorah with brachas. And that makes a lot of sense, because the mitzvah is for women to light alongside of it. We haven't yet dealt with the question of the woman lighting as a shliach of her husband. We'll have a look at that a bit more next week. This is all we have time for today. Nice to see you all. I wish you hatzlacha rabbah. Enjoy Hanukkah. Enjoy the Yontov of Hanukkah with your families and by yourselves and with the community. It's a most beautiful, beautiful Yontov.